Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 18th of February 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Sometimes we're live, sometimes we're pre-recorded. Today this episode is pre-recorded, but I do have with me my co-host, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts community. Patriarch, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm looking forward to getting into this episode. I think we've got some original research here, which listeners may not be aware of before. It's a subject that I'm very much interested in, which is British history. We've looked at all these other countries and all these other empires, and we've done a little bit about British history when we talked about the Cornish tin trade in the past, but we haven't really sort of covered all of it. And what I think we should do is start right at the very beginning, look at the legends, look at the myths, and work our way through the most important points of British history. I think today, when they look at British history in the schools, they try to diversify it. And when I was at school, all I can remember about British history was Jethro Tull's seed drill. And I think today it's pretty similar. They talk about enclosures, and then they'll try to bring black Africans into it, and they'll pretend that people from North Africa in Roman times were actually black when they weren't. But there's lots of really interesting stuff that people are probably not aware of. I mean, just like the name of Britain itself, most people are unaware that that comes from Brutus, the Trojan prince. And they will try and say today that that's all mythical. But it's not. There's loads of evidence for it. And we're going to start even before Brutus. But before we get into that, you got any comments on that?
I'm just quite excited, really, to dig into this because, you know, I guess I've been somewhat ignorant of British history from the, from a less mainstream skew of things. You know, we've got the stuff that we've been taught in schools, like in the Normans, the Saxons and whatnot, so you've got the general overview, but you know, like you say, there's no real affiliation or connection to the Romans, other than they were here and kind of conquered us, but there's no kind of link as kindred people, you know, or just connected in that way.
Well, we'll see that they are all connected up. And the main difference between mainstream scholarship is that mainstream scholarship will pretend that the ancient Britons were just savages wearing bearskins until the Romans came along. And that is just not true, as we saw when we looked at the Cornish tin trade. And the Angles and the Saxons, when the Saxons came over, they tried to portray the British as if they were a bit backwards, but they couldn't. I mean, even the Venerable Bede, or the Execrable Bede, whichever way you prefer to pronounce his name, he had to admit that there were bishops here and Christianity had been here for a couple of hundred years, which shows that the British were highly advanced. And then even when the Saxons came here, Alfred the Great had to go to Wales to get Bishop Asser to actually teach the Saxons how to read and write. So that just shows you. And Baron Blackett and Alan Wilson, they say the only reason that the Saxons were able to take Britain is because there was a comet. And there was a comet which destroyed lots of South America, and it's on the same plane to have come over Britain. And that's where all the stories of King Arthur's Wasteland comes from. And you can see the evidence of the damaged rocks. And there were no harvests. And this came right after all the young men had actually left onto Europe following, I think it was King Arthur. So there weren't any strong males left in the country to defend it. And all the rest had moved to Brittany, basically. So there was hardly anybody here. Because if you compare what happened with Rome, and you said there that Rome conquered Britain, in actual fact, we defeated Rome twice. We defeated Caesar. We sent him packing back to France with his tail between his legs. And before that, we had two kings, Brennus and Belinus, and they advanced onto the continent and they sacked Rome and put themselves in charge. And that's in Roman records as the blackest day ever in Rome's history. And that's talked about by the mainstream as if they were Gaulish chieftains, because they were our brothers on the continent. They were the same ethnicity, basically.
When we We beat them. Is this pre-Brutus or post-Brutus?
Post-Brutus. Okay. As we will see here, what we're going to talk about today is the earliest reference that we have, which is to Albion, and where we get the name Albion for the country. And then some centuries after that, Brutus came to the country. And when we get to that, we'll talk about it in detail. He came after the Trojan War. The official time for the Trojan War is about the 11th or the 12th century. Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett place it around about the 6th century. And they have reasons for that, which do tie in, actually. If you remember when we were talking about Carthage and when we were talking about Dido, that was round about the 7th century, I think, the 8th century. And what happened in that is tied to the people that fled Troy. So what it's saying there in the references to Dido is that the fall of Troy happened about the 7th century or the 8th century. Whereas the official narrative is that it happened in the 11th and the 12th century. And it's difficult because with it happening in the 11th and the 12th century, it ties in to a lot of Christian identity research. But then again, Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett's research also ties into Christian identity research. And they say that when Brutus came to Britain in the 6th century, that was essentially that movement of the Cimmerians coming over from just around Iran there and above Assyria, where they're talked about in the Behistun Rock. They made their way through into Britain from there, and he claims that that was tied in, or Baron Blackett and Alan Wilson do, they claim that that was tied in with Brutus of Troy and his movement into Britain. So we're not sure whether the fall of Troy was in the 6th century or the 12th century, but we'll look at that more closely when we actually get to it. As I say, we're going to start today with the very first founding myth of Britain, which is the legend of Albion. And I've translated this from Middle English, basically. It's quite difficult to do because it's only available in Middle English. And it's available in a book called The Brute or The Chronicle of England, which is a wonderful book. It was basically that was the history of Britain for centuries. Wikipedia tell us about it. They say the Brute Chronicle, also known as the Prose Brute, is the collective name for a number of medieval chronicles containing the history of England. The original Prose Brute was written in Anglo-Norman. It was subsequently translated into Latin and Middle English. The chronicle begins England's history with the legend of Albion, followed by the mythological founding of Britain by Brutus of Troy, named Brute in French and English. Brutus is the legendary great-grandson of Innes, and his founding of Britain thus links the country to the grand history of Troy. And, of course, this is why Edward I, His Royal Highness Edward Longshanks, referred to London as Troy Nova, the new Troy, and why the original inhabitants of London were known as the Trinovantes, so the new people from Troy, the new Trojans. The first Anglo-Norman versions end with the death of King Henry III in 1272, making them eyewitness accounts for the history of that period, and therefore the most accurate history. And they continue on from 1272. And we have a Greatest Britain's podcast on Edward Longshanks, based on the Brute record, that can be found here at Radio Albion. And that contains original research as well that listeners may not be aware of. Subsequent versions of the Brute extended the narrative. 50 versions in Anglo-Norman remain in 49 manuscripts in a variety of versions and stages. Latin translations of the Anglo-Norman versions remain in 19 different versions, which fall into two main categories, some of which were subsequently translated into Middle English, which is the copy that I've been translating from. There are no fewer than 184 versions of the English translation of the work in 181 medieval and post-medieval manuscripts, the highest number of manuscripts for any text in Middle English except for Wycliffe's Bible. The sheer number of copies that survive and its late 14th century translation into the vernacular, indicating the growth in common literacy, show the importance of the text itself. It was second only in popularity to the Bible and was considered England's official history from the 12th century right up to the 19th. It is considered central to the literary culture of late medieval England, and references to events within it are found throughout Shakespeare and elsewhere, and the Faerie Queen, that's a famous book that refers to it. And the mainstream will try and say that it was compiled from Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of England. And that is not true, because there are references in the Brut to things which are talked about by Gildas, that are talked about by Nennius, that are talked about by Bede, talked about by Caesar. I mean, this was the history of Britain. If they were just making it up, as Geoffrey of Monmouth has been accused of doing, then people would have said, well, that's not accurate. That's not our history. We know what our history is. And we had libraries that were burned down. The Glastonbury Library was burned down, I think, in the 11th century. The really early records that we had that were actually kept by the Welsh, they were pronounced to be illegal, and they had to be hidden away. And when they put the Welsh princes in the Tower in London, they had their records with them, and they were destroyed. So we don't have many of these records left, but we do actually have them. We have lots of Welsh records, and we also have the place names. As I say, New Troy, the Trinovantes, that's one of them. Why else were this tribe called the Trinovantes if not from New Troy? And they were known as that in Caesar's time. So there's lots of evidence to show that these are accurate. Obviously, you've got mythical components to them, and you have to separate the truth from the myth. But the very fact there is a myth that's grown up around them shows you how long these records have been around.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just considering their connection to Latin, first of all. I mean, I know, you know, we know that our language comes from there, but it kind of just highlights where our roots lie, you know, and how heavily we have been influenced with Latin as a language.
Well, yeah. Latin comes from Latium, and Innes married the daughter of the king of Latium, and he built up the city that Romulus had started, which actually became Rome. And again, this is what ties in with this 6th century timing for the fall of Troy, because Innes supposedly helped found Rome, and Rome was around about that time, basically. But our English, really, I think, I mean, it comes from Phoenician, but obviously Latin comes from Phoenician as well. If you look at the Phoenician script, you can see today that there are similarities with the actual alphabet that they had, and that was the first alphabet rather than cuneiform or hieroglyphics.
Doesn't Latin kind of derive itself from Greek as well, though?
Well, Greek comes from Phoenician too.
If you was to put them in order, you'd have Phoenician, Greek, then Latin, and then the English language alphabet, and you can see the evolution of it.
Well, there's also the Colburn alphabet as well. Apparently, we had an alphabet in English before we actually had Old English that was the Colburn alphabet, which, again, it gets ignored and hidden. And yet you can see that there is this alphabet that's written on things from way back when. And there's also people that say that the language that we have comes from the Iceni tribe, and it's Isinglas. And that's actually English. And somebody will put forward the proof for that. They will say, well, somebody from Wales today can understand what somebody says in Brittany. They can understand what somebody says in Cornwall because they have Over. This original language. Yet Wales has been separated from Brittany for 1,000 years, 1,500 years. Now, can somebody who speaks English understand German today? No, they can't. So people would suggest that actually the English we have is not derived from German, but it is actually the original language of the Iceni, which is the tribe that Boadicea came from. Because there are records, I think, from the 8th century, which say the language which is spoken in Britain is Isinglas, from the Iceni tribe. That is the language that everybody speaks, the common language, which would be the same as what we have today.
I just had a quick look at the Colbrum. C-O-E-L-B-R-E-N, for anyone else that's listening. And it's quite you can see where it fits in place almost, you know. It's kind of it feels like it came a little bit after sort of the, you know, Phoenicia, but you can see how it starts to it just evolve and it feels closer to our own, you know, English today.
Yeah, we perhaps we'll have a look at the Colburn alphabet along the way. But as I say, this legend of Albion, it comes from the Brute. It's right at the beginning of the Brute, and that's what I want to begin with. And you'll have to bear with my translation. I've still used some of the old words in it. It's quite interesting there. It actually has "you know" in there, and you know, people say "you know" today, don't they? And clearly, right, 1,000 years ago when this was being written, that's what people were saying. And it's written in text speak as well. It's spelled UNOW, you know. And it also uses the word diverse to mean evil or wicked. So diversity was seen as evil and wicked back then. So that's just two interesting points that I picked up on as I was doing this translation. Well, it begins, and the title is "How King Diocletian Wedded His 33 Daughters to 33 Kings, Whom They Afterwards Murdered, and How These Widows Came to England and Had Children by the Giants of the Land." So we can see from that King Diocletian, it cannot have actually been Diocletian. Diocletian was a Roman emperor, so there must be a different reason why he's called that. He must have been actually had a different name, and Diocletian must have been added to his name at some point after the events. It says here they had children by the giants of the land, so that's obviously mythical, so there must be something else that's at the root of that, and we'll get to that as we go along. What do you want to add? Do you want to add something?
My initial thought on giants of the land is, I guess, would be similar to how the how they were perceived back in biblical times. Whereas giants might not necessarily have been, you know, giant in stature, but men of renown, you know, powerful men, and giant in popularity, in status. Do you think that's got some credibility to it?
Yeah, that could well be it. And also we have these giant megalithic structures, and people could have looked at those and thought, well, giants must have built them, because I don't know how we would build them, putting these giant rocks up. And there's also a tribe which we will get to, the Gutians, and it may well have been referring to the Gutians, because it actually says the G-E-A-U-N-T-E-S, Giantes. So you don't quite know that it is giants or quite what they were referring to. And it's interesting talking about giants of men, but we also have these giant corporations today as well. You know, Google all the rest of them, mega corporations, and they are like giants, aren't they? They you know, they can just crush the small man, and they have an influence and an effect everywhere. So that's a summary of what happens in the story. The story begins, "In the noble land of Syria, there was a noble king and mighty, a man of great renown, that was known as Diocletian, who well and worthily governed and ruled through his noble chivalry, so that he conquered all of the lands about him, and almost all the kings of the world to him were subject." So we're talking about a place in the Near East. We're talking about Syria. Have we got any connections to Syria in Britain? Well, we do. We have the county of Surrey, which is named after Syria. And we have records of a people living in Britain that were referred to as the Old Syrians, spelled E-A-L-D-E, and then the Syria is spelt with a C. So we do have this connection with Syria. Back then, obviously, Syria was white and it was a center of civilization. And the time that we're talking about is when civilization was in Mesopotamia. So it included Babylon, Akkad, Syria, Assyria, all of that area there. This was a huge king. It tells us that almost all the kings of the world to him were subject. And we have this name, Diocletian. And looking at Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett's work, they say that this Diocletian, his actual name was Dungi. And Dungi was a great king of Ur. And Dungi is known by the establishment today as Shulgi, but originally he was known as Dungi. And the reason why his name changed to Dungi is because he deified himself as a god. He was such a huge king that he deified himself as God. And when he did that, he changed the first part of his name to Digia, which is deification, which is Dio. And of course, then you have this Dioclesian. So you have the first word there at the center. And this King Shulgi, he constructed the great ziggurat of Ur, which listeners have probably seen. He was the ruler of the third dynasty of Ur, of the Chaldees, and he styled himself as the king of the four corners of the universe. He also styled himself as the king of man. And he was also the ruler of 33 provinces, and he made his daughters rulers of some of them by marrying them off to the rulers of Persia, Elam, and Syria. And Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett, they date this Dungi to being around in 1600 BC, whereas the mainstream say that he was around in 2000 BC. Now, also, William Fink says that the dating of the civilization in Mesopotamia is far too early. He says it is much later than we're told by the mainstream as well. So I'm inclined to believe that this is correct, that it was actually about 1600 BC, because that would also tie in with when we know about the Cornish tin workings around 1600. And we know that the Bronze Age could only have happened in the Near East if they were getting their tin from Cornwall. So whatever stage it is that we can trace back the tin to in Cornwall, that's the time when they had the Bronze Age. So when they say it was 2000 BC, 2500 BC, that's too early for them to actually have it. He was the first long-distance runner. He ran for 100 miles. He's recorded as doing that. He called himself the King of the Four Quarters, and he also called himself the Pastor of the Black-Headed People. And you remember in the first couple of episodes, we were talking about the Black-Headed People of Mesopotamia and how they were created. He led a major modernization of the Third Dynasty of Ur. He improved communications, reorganized the army, reformed the writing system and weights and measures, unified the tax system, and created a strong bureaucracy. And he also promulgated the law code known as the Code of Ur-Nammu, who was his father. And people may have heard of Ur-Nammu before. I mean, this is a very, very highly placed king who had a lot of similarities to this king that we're told about here, this Diocletian, who worthily governed and ruled through his noble chivalry so that he conquered all of the lands about him, and almost all the kings of the world to him were subject. And of course, the world was the four quarters of the world was basically Mesopotamia. That was the known world. That was the civilized world at the time. Anything outside of that was just not known about. It wasn't included when we talk about the world. So continuing here, it befell thus that this Diocletian espoused a gentle damsel that was wondrously fair, and this was his enemy, Labanna's daughter. Now she loved him as reason would, and he sired upon her 33 daughters, of which the eldest was called Albion. And these damsels, when they came of age, they became so fair to look upon that it was a wonder to behold. Wherefore this Diocletian decided to hold a gathering, and he commanded in writing that all of the kings that were subject to him should attend on a certain day, as in his letters was contained a command to make a royal feast. So we've got a few things here. We've got his enemy was called Laban, and Laban is a famous name from the Bible. Laban was the brother of Rebekah, who married Isaac and bore Jacob. Laban welcomed his nephew Jacob as a young man, and he set in the stipulation of 7 years' labor before he permitted him to marry his daughter Rachel. But Laban actually tricked Jacob into marrying his elder daughter Leah instead, and Jacob then took Rachel as his second wife on condition of serving an additional 7 years' labor. So we know of a famous Laban from the Bible, the one that whose daughter married Isaac. We're not told about any other daughters, and it may have been a different Laban that's being referred to here. But Laban from the Bible and his family are described as dwelling in Padan Aram in Mesopotamia, which was part of the Hittite Empire. And the Hittite Empire were enemies to Dungi's empire. Now, it doesn't mean that Laban was a Hittite, it just means that he was a part of the Hittite empire. Laban, the word itself, means white It means the visual representation of purity without any visible stain, symbolizing those without apparent evil motives. Albion as well, the name of the daughter, also means white. It comes from Albinus. We also have a Labanus II at that time, who was a great king of the Hittite Empire, and he invaded and took part of Syria, taking Aleppo and actually putting him in conflict with Dungi. So we have a Labanus II, and we have somebody named Laban who was an enemy of this king. So, I mean, it all fits together that this is what was going on, and these were the names that they actually had in Syria. Now, this Labanus, I mean, it may have actually been Abraham's brother. We do know that Abraham was highly thought of by these Hittites because they wanted to give a field to him with a cave in it. He wanted to buy it, and they said, no, we want to give you this. And you would only do that if the person was highly honourable. The actual a field with a cave in it as well, that had to have been a tumulus with a dolmen. I mean, it had to be a man-made cave, one of these great megaliths like we have now, like a barrow that was actually in this field. And the Hittites wanted to give it to him. So that shows he was greatly honoured. That shows that his brother Laban may have been greatly honoured. And it may be that he was related to this king, or he may have actually been this this great king. We just don't know. We don't have enough information from that time. But we do know that Laban was a name that was used in that part of Syria. And then we have this story here. I mean, how did they know this in Britain at that time? Or what was going on in Syria? I mean, this tends to say, well, this is a truthful recollection of it, because it's got these accurate names and it's got an accurate story of what was going on. And then we also have this connection with the name. Laban means white, and Albion also means white. So Dungi married Laban's daughter and had a daughter of his own that was wondrously fair and beautiful, obviously white. And she was actually named Albion, which means white. And when they say people were fair, that's pretty much what it means. It means that they were white people.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of these Hebrew Israelites, they claim, they try to change the meaning of fair to basically just mean beautiful, and it has no reflection on the complexion or anything. It's just literally fair was beautiful.
You mean the black Hebrew Israelites?
Yeah, sorry, black Hebrew Israelites, yeah.
Yeah, you do wonder how they can sort of change these physical descriptions of people in the Bible, which say blue eyes, blonde hair, rosy-cheeked, fair.
Yeah.
People that blush.
The only definition which refers to them as black is one where it's actually frowning upon it and almost saying that I've been out working in the fields all day, my skin is black. But that's obviously hyperbole as well. And I think it was burnt. The underlying word is not actually black, it's burnt.
And that wouldn't happen if you were black or white. You wouldn't get sunburnt. That would only happen if you were white. So getting back to our tale here. On the day which they said they would come, they brought with them admirals, princes, dukes, and all their noble chivalry. The feast was royally arrayed, and there they celebrated in so much joy and mirth, you know, that it was a wonder to behold. And it befell thus that this Diocletian thought to marry his daughters among all the knights that were there on that solemn night. And as they had spoken, so they did, that Albion, his eldest daughter, and all her sisters were richly married unto the 33 kings that were lords of great honour and also power at this solemn night. And when the solemn night was done, each king took home his wife and went they into their own country, and there they made them all queen. And again, I mean, we know also that what the Hittites used to do, they used to marry off their princesses to the leaders of other countries to make these alliances. So we have this Laban, who was from the Hittite Empire. We don't know if he was ethnically a Hittite or not. And his daughter married the king of the Mesopotamian Empire. And then the king of the Mesopotamian Empire married out his daughters to the rulers that were under him, because he was a ruler of 33 different provinces. So he had the ruler of Elam, you had the ruler of Persia, all these different rulers that were actually under him, and they married his daughters. So he's thinking, this is pretty good. We've now got alliances here. Everybody's going to be loyal to me. We've even solved this problem with this king of the Hittites, and I've married his daughter. So he thinks it's all looking good for him. But it befell thus afterwards that this dame Albion became so stout and so stern that she gave little value to all that her lord did, and of him she had scorn and despite, and she would not do his will, but would have her own will in diverse manners. So she wouldn't do as she was instructed. She wouldn't obey her husband as she should have done. She thought that she was above her husband, basically, and tried to cause as much trouble as she could. And we can see here this word diverse manners. So it's being used in a negative sense, certainly not in a positive sense. And all her other sisters, each one of them, bore them so evil a yen towards their lords that it was a wonder to behold. And the reason for this was that they thought their husbands to not be of such high breeding as their father was. So we see here, right at the very beginning of our history, in our oldest legend that we have in Britain, the importance of breeding is highlighted, and the importance of who you marry. And these were white people that they had married, but they didn't think that they were of a high enough breeding as their father was, because he was king of the world. So how are you going to find husbands for your daughters when you're the king of the world? He's got no equals. And that was what they wanted, was equals.
And so they're still very much into the caste system.
Yeah.
You know, if you were royal-blooded and high of a high caste, then obviously they wanted to perpetuate their genes with other people that are at the top, really.
Well, you can also see that the idea of marrying one of these black-headed people would have been absolutely out of the question. They think that it's wrong that they've married the princes of these provinces. So you wouldn't have had somebody white marrying somebody black. I mean, they were not just a different caste, but they were a different ethnicity altogether. I mean, this shows you that who you marry was seen as vitally important all the way back then. And we're told today, oh, love is love. It doesn't matter who you marry, just interbreed and intermix. And it goes totally against our traditions of back then. There's a story also in the Book of the Danes about this as well, where somebody, I think it's a woman, a princess or whatever, she marries somebody of a lower caste. And then the son identifies with the mother and not with the father, and he hates the father. And the moral of the story is that if you marry down, the child will always hate the person that actually married down, because they could have been born with the same breeding as their father, but their father decided to marry below him, and the mother had managed to convince somebody higher than them to marry them, so they deserve respect because of that. And I mean, yeah. We do see similar today. When people are born of mixed race marriage, they identify with the non-white parent, because naturally they see it as they've married this other race. They've married up. They've managed to marry a white person, basically. I'm not trying to be racist there or anything. That's the way that society is. If you go to these non-white countries, there's a massive industry in skin whitening, and being white has always been seen as the ideal of beauty. If we look in India, they had a caste system, and the white people, originally they were all white apart from the untouchables, but eventually it was just the Brahmins that were white, and they still have a caste system that's based on race today. So this story that it was important who you married, and the offspring of a mixed marriage would identify with the lower part of the marriage, or would identify with the non-white part of the marriage, is still exactly the same today. and non-white or mixed race children will always identify with the non-white parent, because they instinctively see it that that non-white parent managed to marry upwards, so they deserve respect. And the white parent didn't honor his ancestors. He didn't marry somebody that looked like him. He broke off that line, and the child is mixed race as a response. So as a result, it's not the non-white parent's fault. It's the white parent's fault for doing that, if you can see what I mean. It is always the white person's fault, not the non-white, when that happens. And really, I mean, that's why the punishment after the flood was of the white people. It wasn't of the mixed races. It was the Adamites that were done for, because they had married these people that they had been told not to marry. The people they'd been told not to marry, that they weren't given a law. They weren't told don't interbreed with these white people. It was the white people that were told not to interbreed with these others. Otherwise, you will cease being the people that you originally were. So they were punished with a flood. And we can see here that it's right in our first legend that we have. Breeding is absolutely essential. And because these women have not been married to their equals, they are misbehaving in a very, very bad way. So the kings that were now their lords tried chastising them with fair speeches and behests, and also with gifts, and warned them in a very fair manner, with all love and friendship, that they should amend their unreasonable expectations. But alas, it was all for naught, for they continued to do their own will in all things that they liked and had power over. So, I mean, maybe they were a little bit like feminists back then, and they refused to do what their lords told them to, what their husbands told them to. Wherefore, those 33 kings, upon a time, and then oftentimes, began beating their wives, for they thought this would amend their bad behaviour and their wicked ways. For of such bad temperament were they, that despite the fair speech and warnings, they still did their worst. And far betides that, some even much worse than that. And the text in Middle English, I mean, it makes it really clear that this was really, really bad behaviour that they did. I mean, for the husbands to end up actually having to beat their wives, it must have been dreadful behaviour that they did. They tried everything else beforehand, fair speeches and behests, giving them gifts, and yet none of it worked. They just wouldn't listen. They would not go along with custom. They would not be courteous. They were just of a bad temperament.
So they wouldn't submit, essentially, to the man.
Yeah, and we can see here that this biblical commandment of Paul that women should submit to the man, this goes back thousands of years. This wasn't something new in Christianity. This is the way that society was. Women were expected to submit to men, and men were expected to protect the women in exchange and to provide for the women as well. It's only because we live in this artificial society today that it isn't the same today. Because, you know, we have civilization here. Men don't go out and attack the women. But if you look at places like Africa, where they don't have much civilization there, there's rapes that go on all the time. If you don't have a man to protect you, you're going to be attacked, and women don't have that much body strength. They have to rely upon the men. Today, they rely upon the state. If if they get divorced and they've got children, the state will help to bring them up. But in the ancient world, if that happened, nobody would help to bring them up. No, another man wouldn't want to marry them and raise another man's children. So they had to obey their lords. And because they couldn't look after themselves, they couldn't do the physical work, the men had to look after them. So it was like a reciprocal arrangement. And what you have here is these women have got ideas above their state, basically, because they were created by their father, and their father said, you need to marry these men. So they're upturning tradition there as well, because the tradition is that you should marry who your parents tell you to marry. That's in the Bible as well. Honor your mother and your father. It means marry who your father and your mother tell you to marry, basically. because they only have your best interests at heart, and they're not going to be suggesting you marry somebody that's going to ill treat you. This king, I mean, it's quite clear that the lords that they were married to did absolutely their very best to win these wives over, fair speeches and behests, but they just wouldn't go along with it. Wherefore, the king that had wedded Albion wrote of the attachments and conditions that his wife Albion had put on the marriage, and a letter was sent to Diocletian, her father. And when all the other kings heard that Albion's lord had sent a letter to Diocletian, they also sent letters sealed with their royal seals, detailing the conditions and attachments of their own wives. So obviously the wives had said, well, we're not going to do this unless you do X, Y, and Z. And then the kings have done X, Y, and Z. And the wives have said, well, we're still not going to do it unless you do A, B, and C as well. Hmm. And making unreasonable expectations of their husbands. And what's at the root of it is that they don't think that the husbands are their equals.
So they look down on the husbands?
Yeah.
Was that going back to the original point of do they feel like they were marrying down then? And no, yeah. Because their father was of such high stature, they almost would have wanted someone to be higher than their father.
Yes, or equal. And the father had no equals. He was the king of the four corners of the universe. He was the king of all of civilization, the biggest king in the world at the time. And they'd got this idea that they needed to have somebody like that.
So I think they sound spoiled ultimately, though, don't they? I mean, they must have been used to having everything, and they, you know, wouldn't have to lift a finger. and as a father, if you're the greatest, you've obviously dedicated a lot of your time to ruling and having other affairs outside of your children. So I can't imagine that he gained their respect as a father. You know, and I think a lot of women, when they tend to, you know, have daddy issues, they tend to be very rebellious.
Well, he clearly never gave them any boundaries. Yeah, they must have been very, very spoiled. They must have just been given everything that they wanted. So it's a lesson not to just give daughters whatever it is that they want. You have to have boundaries there. When King Diocletian saw and heard so many complaints of his daughters, he was sore ashamed and became wonder angry and wroth towards his daughters. And he thought both night and day how he so might amend it that they no longer misdeeded. And after a while he sent his own letters unto those 33 kings, instructing them to come to him and bring with them their wives, every one of them on a certain day, for he would write there and then chastise them of their wickedness, if he might in any manner wise be able to correct them. So the 33 kings all came at the right day and time that had been arranged between them, and the King Diocletian's underlings with muckle honour made a solemn feast for all that were under his lordship. And after the third day of that solemn feast, the King Diocletian sent for his 33 daughters, that they should come and speak with him in his chamber. Now when they were come into the chamber, he spake unto them of their wickedness and of their cruelty, and spiritedly of them he reproved. And understand this to them, he said, that if they would not be chastised, they should lose his love for evermore. And when the ladies heard all this, they became abashed and greatly ashamed. And to their father they said that they would make amends. I mean, it really must have shamed him, this, his daughters, to be behaving like this. I mean, he's well loved and rules very well, and yet his daughters have now got a name for nothing but wickedness and cruelty. And you also think they were incredibly beautiful as well. So maybe there's a lesson there too. Spoiling somebody who is beautiful and just telling them they're beautiful all the time, it's just going to bring out the wickedness in them.
Well, they probably think, I've heard it all before. It's nothing new. They're probably bored as well.
Not excited enough by their
or maybe the men were so in awe of them that they failed to be men themselves. I don't know. Dealing with women are an odd. I'll say indifferent to us, and if we don't align ourselves with our true kind of nature, then I don't think women will align themselves with theirs.
Yeah, you got a point there. A man has to be a man before his woman will be a woman. But I think another thing that this implies here is that there was more solidarity between men back then, because these men ended up having to beat their wives. And they weren't worried that the father of the women was going to punish them for that. I mean, they wrote to him and said, look, we have ended up having to beat our wives because they have been so badly behaved. And the father is on their side and understands that these women must have behaved in an absolutely terrible way for that to have become necessary. I mean, otherwise he would have been furious at these princes. So that we had a much more of a sense of solidarity between men back then.
Yeah, well, I think it was obviously quite normal as well to beat your wife back then, wasn't it?
Well, no,
if they were
well
out of line.
Yeah, if they were very badly behaved, it was considered normal, but not, you know, just casually.
Yeah.
And we can see here that they had tried them with gifts, plied them with gifts and behests and been courteous and with all fairness and all love, tried to talk to them and say, look, you're upsetting people here, but they wouldn't have it.
Hmm.
And I mean, really, I guess that the beating was say, look, you know, this is the last, your last chance. If not, we're going to have to write to your father and see what he can do about it. So he was very, very angry at them and reproved them. So they departed out from their father's chamber. But Dame Albion, who was the eldest sister, led them all into her own chamber and made void all that were therein, so that no life was among them, but she and her own sisters. And said this Albion to her sisters, my fair sisters, full well we know that the king, our father, hath us reproved. He has shamed and despised us, for to try and make us obedient unto our husbands. But be certain of this, that shall never be, not whilst I live. Seeth you all that I am come from a more higher king's blood than my husband is? And when she had so said, all her sisters agreed the same. And so, said Albion, full well ye ken, fair sisters, that our husbands have turned our own father upon us, wherefore he hath just foully reproved and despised us. Wherefore, sisters, my counsel is this, that this night, when our husbands be asleep in bed, all we, with one assent, shall cut their throats. And then finally, we will be in peace of them. And it is better that we do this thing now, while under our own father's power, than elsewhere. And as one, all the ladies consented and granted unto this counsel. I mean, that's incredibly wicked, isn't it? You know, their husbands are asleep in bed, trusting them because they're their wives, and they're just going to slaughter them. And she wants to do it there and then, while they're in their own father's grounds, so that they're not punished by the people whose king they've just slaughtered. I mean, they're talking about regicide here. And this is one wicked bitch, isn't it, really, when you think about it? Very ungrateful for what she's been given. So when the night drew to a close and all the lords and ladies went to bed, and once their lords were fast asleep, the daughters all cut their husbands' throats and they slew them all right there in their beds. Interesting that they call their husbands their lords as well. Now that was quite clearly the way that things were looked upon. The husband was the lord. And the lady, I guess, was his helpmate. I mean, that's what it says in the Bible, isn't it? The woman is supposed to be a helpmate, to the husband. Now, when the king Diocletian, her father, heard of this thing, he became hugely wroth against his daughters, and he would have had them all burnt. But all the barons and lords of Syria counselled him not to do such a stern thing to his own daughters, that it would be enough for him to void the land of them for evermore, and make it so that they could never again come into their homeland. And so he did as they advised. And this is interesting as well. I mean, there was an old tradition that you couldn't actually punish a woman. It was uncivilized, unchivalrous, unnatural to punish a woman. So you couldn't take them to court. You couldn't have them in court as a witness either, because they couldn't testify, because they couldn't be punished. They couldn't be tortured in any way. So they were protected from that sort of thing happening, but at the same time, they couldn't actually take place in court. But the person who could be punished was the husband. If the wife did something wrong that was against the law, it was the husband that was actually punished for this, because he was responsible for the woman. It was considered to be not the right thing to do, to allow a woman to be responsible for herself. As I say, because it would not be right to be punishing a woman. It would not be right to be fighting a woman, torturing a woman to find out what the truth was. So that they were considered to be irresponsible or not responsible for themselves. But in a way, they had everything provided for them. Everything was done for them. Totally different way of doing things today. I mean, when Dame Cresta Dick just stepped down, there was a news report, and it was saying how wonderful it was that this woman was leading the police force, and what an image that portrayed to the rest of the world. And I thought, well, what image does that portray to the rest of the world? It portrays an image that all the men are too weak to lead the police. We don't have any men left. We have women that have replaced the men in a strong man role, which is a role that was traditionally carried out by a strong man, and it needed to be in order to keep the law, and they replaced them with a woman. So that was the message that it actually sent, is Britain is weak. I mean, you wouldn't see the same thing happening in Russia. Apparently there are women leading all the defense departments in most of Europe now, actually leading the army.
Yeah.
And what image does that say? Send it. It says all the men are too weak to do the job, so the women are doing it instead.
You know, a lot of the female prime ministers, you know, you've got Australia, you've got Germany, and I'm not sure about Austria, Scotland, and they're quite, you know, out of everyone with the COVID sanctions and restrictions, they're some of the most, you know, strict and harsh, aren't they, really?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's, you know, women don't have much sympathy unless it's their own children. They don't tend to have much sympathy because they're not evolved to do that. They're evolved to put their children first and to care and protect for their children more than anything else. If they were evolved to have sympathy for others, then their own children would be neglected. So they're not, you know, then it's not a natural thing for them to have sympathy for others. Of course, women do have sympathy for others, but essentially they're supposed to have that sympathy for their own flesh and blood so that they can protect them. And so Diocletian, that was their father, commanded them to go down into a ship, and he delivered to them enough victuals to survive for half a year. And when this was done, with all the sisters in the ship, it sailed forth into the sea, and betook they all their friends in their religion to Apollyon, that was their god. So they were accompanied by a retinue. It wasn't just the women, it was all their associates. And there is this Apollyon, who apparently wasn't Apollo. Apollyon was the destroyer. So it was a devilish god that they're saying here that they worshipped. And they had enough victuals to survive for half a year. And I wonder how long it would take to get to Britain from Syria. Possibly 6 months. I mean, I'm
traveling
not sure.
by horse and carriage, I guess.
No, traveling by ship. They've been put down in a ship, yes. So it would have been a fleet of ships, I should imagine, rather than just a ship. But
yeah, so they'd be going down the Mediterranean coastlands, and then up to Britain, wouldn't they?
Yeah, out through the Pillars of Hercules.
How long do you think? A week.
And this is before the Phoenician Empire would have closed that off. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they knew of this myth of this island that was full of tin that was in the north there.
Well, something must have attracted them there, though, right?
Well, it says, and so long they sailed into the sea, until at last they came and arrived at an isle that was all wilderness. And when the Dame Albion was come to that land and all her sisters, this Albion went first out of the ship and said to her other sisters, for as much, quoth she, as I am the eldest sister of all this company, and the first this land has taken, and for as much as my name is Albion, I will that this land be called Albion after my own name. And anon, all the sisters there granted it her with a good will. So this is where we get the name Albion from. And it was all wilderness when they came here. There was nobody here on the island, according to them, according to this story. So they were the first here. So went out the sisters of the ship and took in the land Albion, as their sister called it. And there they went up and down and found neither man nor woman nor child, but wild beasts of diverse kinds. And when their victuals were dispensed, and they had failed them, they fed themselves with herbs and fruits according to the season of the year, and so they lived as best they might. And after that they took the flesh of the diverse beasts they found, and became wonder fat, and they desired man's company and man's kind, the very kind that they had failed, so that they more desired man's company than any other form of solace or mirth. So now we're being told that it was all just women that went. I don't think it was all just women that went. I think that line about them taking their friends and the worshippers of Apollyon, I think that they must have actually had men with them. But when they're compiling this legend later on, they're saying, well, they were kicked out and it was just the women on their own. But the idea that there was just 33 women on a ship and, you know, they managed to make their way all the way to Britain and then survive, it's not possible. They must have had men with them. But because the story is that it was these 33 women, the compilers had to come up with an idea of how they managed to replace themselves and how they managed to become the first inhabitants. So the story continues. When the devil perceived this, he went by diverse countries, and likening himself to nature's shade of man, he came into the land of Albion, and lay with the women, and he shed his nature upon them, and they conceived. And after this they brought forth giants, one of which was called Gogmagog, and another Lothrigan, and so they were named by diverse names. And in this manner they came forth, and there were born horrible giants in Albion, and they dwelled in the caves and in the hills at their will, and they had the land of Albion exactly as they liked, until the time that Brutus arrived and came to Totnes, that was in the Isle of Albion. It was there that this Brutus conquered and discomfited the above-said giants. And later on we'll hear there's a legend where Brutus's friend Carinius fights with this giant Gogmagog. And obviously the giant Gogmagog must have been the same size as Carinius, and must have been one of the descendants of the original people that were there. And when Brutus gets there, he actually calls England Logria. And the word Logria actually comes from the moon, Logris, England. And Lur actually means moon. And the people of Ur, which is where Dungi came from, where these women came from, they were moon worshippers. So we have another connection there with that. And then we have this word giants. And Alan Wilson and Baron Brackett, they put it forward that this word giants was actually Gutium, which is a place in modern Iran. And looking at what Wikipedia has to say about Gutium, they say W.B. Henning suggested that the different endings of the Gutian king names resembled case endings in the Tocharian languages, a branch of Indo-European known from texts found in the Tarim Basin in the northwest of modern China, dating from the 6th to the 8th centuries BC, making Gutian the earliest documented Indo-European language. He further suggested that they had subsequently migrated to the Tarim. And of course, we've talked about the Tarim Basin. We talked about the Tocharians. So we know that these Gutians were white, And Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett, they suggest that where it's talking about these giants that that were there, it was actually the Gutium that were there, that were from this area in Iran, which was a moon-worshipping area. And I think that would have been the people that accompanied them. I think they said they worshipped Apollyon because they'd just done this horrible deed and they'd murdered all their husbands. So they're saying that they're devilish. And the people that they took with them would have been their associates. And that's where the colony in Britain will have started from. And then when we hear the story of Brutus, it sounds like he stays to the west with his men. And the Logrians, the descendants of Albion, they stay towards the east. But Brutus does come and they do have a battle with them. And Brutus is victorious in the battle and he ends up being the king of the whole country. And he splits the country into three. So we have this very early tale, which ties in with events in Syria at that time. There was this great king and he married off his daughters. His enemy was called Laban. And at that time, there was a Laban that was in that area. It was either a common name or it was a name that was used by royalty. And then we have this connection with Isaac and a connection with the Israelites because he married into Laban. Laban was actually a Hebrew that was living in part of the Hittite Empire. And also at this time, 1600 BC, that's when we first find the evidence of the tin mining in Cornwall. So that was the first time that people actually came over to here from Assyria. I mean, we were suggesting when we did our section on the tin mining, we were saying that the original ones must have come over from Assyria. Of course, Assyria is right next to Syria. So not only do we have these references in the Near East of the Assyrians coming to Britain and collecting the tin at that time, we now have this legend that's held by the British, which talk about colonizers coming over from Syria at exactly that time. We have the old Syrians of Surrey that are mentioned about 800 years ago being here. We have the county itself, Surrey, which comes from the word Syria. So we can see that even though it seems like there are these supernatural elements that have been added to this story, there may very well be truth to it originally.
Yeah, I think it's elements of exaggeration. I'm just curious what the last paragraph means. You know, when the devil perceived this, he went by diverse countries and likened himself to nature's shade of man. He came into the land of Albion and lay with the woman. I mean, that sounds quite similar to, you know, the fallen angels at the beginning of the Bible and taking women for themselves.
And well, they may have taken inspiration from that story because they had to explain how it was that Albion and their daughters actually had children and how there were people there when Brutus got there. So they had to explain that. So rather than saying that they brought their associates with them, which they obviously must have done, they came out with the idea that the devil must have laid with them. And this idea that he did it by likening himself to a man and then came in unto them, that's the same story that they used, or that people used to use, to try to explain the Nephilim and how the angels managed to sleep with the women.
Do you think because they thought themselves to be of such high stature, that this story in some way, they kind of exemplify themselves to that point of being beyond human, and therefore, you know, that.
Well, that's a point,
they're
actually.
They're marrying down.
Yeah, well, that's a point, because their king, their father, deified himself and styled himself as a god. So they may have, they may have been thinking, well, we need deities to breed with, not lowly husbands that this king has given us, because the king himself deified himself. So, I mean, that may be like an element of that to it, like a symmetry to it. His daughters ended up breeding with devils and their father deified himself. I mean, maybe that could have been like a moral of the story at the end of it. Because obviously it would have grown over time, and the original story itself would have made a lot more sense, because there would have been other interlocking stories about what was going on at the time. So there may have been extra bits talking about their father and how he deified himself. And then you end up with the end of it where where his daughters end up breeding with devils. So there was this moral to it. And the bit where it explained that their father deified himself is now no longer there, because you've just got this story of Albion. But we do know from looking into the evidence about this Shulgi, who then changed his name to Dungi. When he changed his name to Dungi, that was because he thought that he was a god and he deified himself.
Yeah.
And obviously this version of the story is being told by Christians, talks about the devil, and it uses that same idea of the fallen angels sleeping with the daughters of men, making wives out of the daughters of men, taking each that they chose. And it is similar the way that it's written, but it is very difficult to actually read exactly what it is and translate these words, because I can't find anywhere a Middle English to Modern English dictionary. You just have to look at the context of what is being said and try to work out what's being said. And some of these words you can look up and find what they mean. But quite a few of them, they just don't have them anywhere. And you've got to look at the context of the sentence to work out what it is that's being said. I do recommend people have a look at The Brute, the Chronicle of England. You can find it on archive.org. You can download the PDF and have a good look through it. I mean, it's a wonderful book. And it is written really well, even in this Middle English. It's lovely to see these old words and the ways that we used to express ourselves and the way that we used to think. I mean, I do highly recommend people actually have a look at the book itself, The Brute, The Chronicle of England. And it's available at archive.org. I think you can also buy copies of it from Amazon. I bought a copy of it some time ago. That's what I use. I've read through it a few times. It's a fascinating book. Anyway, I think we should leave that there for this week, Patriarch. We'll get into Brutus next week. So thank you very much for coming on today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Next week, I do believe we have the PA monthly update. So we will be back a week after that. And until then, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.